Hello, Kristen.
Hi, Bill. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Doing very well. Enjoyed spending Thanksgiving up in your state of residence 2 weeks ago. It's
A
good to be back.
classic New England Thanksgiving. You felt like a pilgrim?
Didn't quite feel like a pilgrim. Did feel very hopeful about the economy. Went out shopping on Black Friday, and the mall was insane, and the sales were not as great as they have been in years past, indicating to me there's probably less excess inventory.
Did you use your special Black Friday strategies to get the sales that you wanted?
I got a pair of boots that were great.
Did you have to like trample over anybody to get them?
No, there are specific strategies you can employ where you avoid things like don't go to Best Buy and try to get the $200 TV. It's just not going to happen. Instead, you find places that are sort of less highly trafficked, but still have really good sales. Outlet malls have lots of gems, so I was successful. My mission for the boots was accomplished.
Excellent. So now the economy is picking up based on your Black Friday experience.
Yes, and so this may mean that Republicans should just pack up their toys and go home for 2012. There's no hope for them. Sale racks are empty. The economy is going again.
I'll restrain myself from quoting you in the future. Speaking of 2012, it does seem to be that the party you are affiliated with, the Republican Party, grand old party, is at minimum seriously considering the nomination of Newt Gingrich to be the presidential nominee, something that no one would have envisioned, even more than a month ago. A voter in Iowa said he was an embarrassment to the party. He should quit before he humiliates himself back in the summer. No one's heard from that guy recently to see what he thinks about what's going on. Is your sense of the conservative blogosphere that what you're seeing in the polls is being reflected by the bloggers, and the bloggers are saying it's time to rally around Newt and ensure that we have a real conservative as a nominee, and let's stop the establishment, stop the Mitt Romney moderate train? Is there still a lot of questioning and groping and deciding where should conservatives put their chips and not assuming that it should be Newt? Where is it solid for Newt, or is it more diffuse?
It's much more diffuse because I think many of the bloggers have longer memories. They remember the summer. Many of them remember the late 90s. They have not forgotten what it appears that many voters either have forgotten or just simply don't care about. You have Eric Erickson at Red State, who has a post up from Wednesday morning entitled "My Confession," where he confesses.
Before you go any more, I just want to make sure you have a disclosure you
Oh,
have to
that's
make.
right. Yes. I do have a disclosure. So my boss is an advisor to Newt Gingrich and his campaign. And while I'm able to present everything to you all that the blogosphere says, it is important that you all know that I work for a man who's affiliated with the Gingrich campaign. So that putting that out there, feel free to take anything I say with a grain of salt,
Right.
but I'm going to do my best to present all of this to you.
I trust your analysis regardless of your paycheck.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. And I myself have not conducted, work for Newt Gingrich, but I think it is important to have that disclosure out there before I go into what the blogs are saying.
All right, so what are the blogs saying about Newt?
So what the blogs are saying, so the Eric Erickson post, his post says he's just not at a position where he says, "I'm just not at a position where I think I can look myself in the mirror and be comfortable knowing I voted for a guy on his third wife who cheated on the first two."
Really? That's the thing? That's the big thing?
Well, in his post, he makes the case that it's not even necessarily the multiple marriages, because he says, plenty of people have get into a marriage and it doesn't work out. But the problem with Newt is that he was breaking his vows by cheating on these women. And so even though Newt says he's a changed man, he's a new person, we have enough doubts about, what he would do and what are his principles really. He kind of contradicts himself a little bit in the post because at one point he says he doesn't like Romney because he doesn't know where Romney stands, yet he's concerned about Newt because he does know where Newt stands. But then, sort of alleges that because Newt has been willing to cheat on his wives, perhaps he would cheat on the conservative movement. He further says that, you know, over Romney, sure, Newt won't, and he thinks that Newt wouldn't be nearly, quote, as devastating down ballot as Romney if things go wrong for the GOP, which is surprising and a little counterintuitive, because I think many folks looking at polls and such would say that Romney, as far as electability and probably risk aversion for the Republican Party, is the better choice, that Newt is a little, is significantly riskier, that if he performs well in debates, perhaps he could pull this off, but if it goes south with Newt, it will go much further south than with Romney. But it has Erickson sort of casting about for, you know, is there anyone else in the field? And he's been walking back his opposition to Huntsman lately, but I think he says that he would support Romney or Newt over Obama, that's not in question, but he's confessing that he is unable to get excited about Newt.
Now, we talk about Eric Erickson, I'd say, disproportionately on this show.
Yes.
I'm not blaming you for that. I do the same things, because he puts himself out there, and he's kind of a sort of an interesting window into a conservative psyche.
Yes.
But if he's taking this stance, this anti-Newt stance, but the polls are due to going up and up and up, does that beg the question, how influential is he, or any other conservative blog for that matter, within the conservative movement? Is Rush's love for Newt more relevant than what the blogosphere is saying about Newt as far as where conservative minds go?
Well, I think it depends a lot on who you assume Iowa caucus voters to be. So if you look at the exit polls from 2008, 54% of Iowa caucus goers in 2008 were either moderate or somewhat conservative, whereas 45% were very conservative. So if you look at moderate and somewhat conservative as separate groups, yes, they're both smaller than the very conservative bloc. But if you kind of put them together, and that's the coalition that someone like Romney, who is not widely beloved by conservative bloggers, he's trying to put that coalition together, that's a bigger coalition than the very conservative. That's a bigger coalition than the folks that are probably really getting riled up by conservative bloggers, even than the folks who are probably getting really riled up by Rush Limbaugh. So I think what you're seeing in these polls is, I mean, the assumption right after Newt's immigration stance in that most recent, not the most recent debate, but the one before it, when he had his sort of bold statement on immigration, was that he would fall in the polls, that this would hurt him in places like Iowa, that it would betray that he's not really conservative, et cetera, et cetera. And that didn't happen. So I think that there's a lot of attention paid to the idea that, like, you need to be super far to the right. This is a strategy that someone like Rick Perry is obviously trying to employ. With his latest ad, he has an ad where he comes out and says that he dislikes that we live in a country where gays can serve openly in the military, yet children can't openly celebrate Christmas. A very controversial ad. So there's this real belief, and a lot of candidates have been running on this strategy of assuming Iowa is super far to the right and we need conservative purists. But if we wanted conservative purists, then why did Michelle Bachmann really kind of implode a bit after Ames? Or, you know, I mean, I think folks aren't just looking for an ideological position. I think folks are looking in many ways for the way someone's demeanor is in a race. And I think that, you know, regardless of Gingrich's positions that are very disconcerting to many conservative bloggers who are very focused on the policy side and the ideological side, you have that sort of, you know, fighter, that somebody who's going to show up to a debate and really, you know, kick some butt. The people who are not conservative bloggers are looking to Newt Gingrich as that kind of guy. And you have folks like, you know, Tina Corby at Hot Air. She writes up about this interview Michelle Bachmann did with Glenn Beck TV, where she calls Newt Gingrich a frugal socialist. For, you know, his support for things like the Medicare Part D prescription drug entitlement program. You have Ramesh Panuru writing at Bloomberg, his latest column, Heartbreak Awaits Republicans Who Love Gingrich, sort of diving back into the stuff that we've already heard time and time again, that he's a riskier choice, that he's erratic, undisciplined, grandiose, that anyone who regularly compares himself to Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher, maybe that's not the best... Maybe that's not the best mindset for someone that we'd like to be commander-in-chief. You have Quinn Hillier at the American Spectator in a post from Tuesday entitled Gingrich's Megalomania, He quotes a 1995 Vanity Fair piece about, you know, Gingrich talking about his own enormous personal ambition to change the entire planet, and warns, you know, "I've heard the man with my own ears refer to himself as a world historical figure. He's the kind of guy who, living out his own personal drama, would welcome the worst sort of brinksmanship, not for the sake of the cause, but for the sake of the brink itself." So there are lots of folks, I think it depends on how long you've been in the conservative movement, where if you are somebody who remembers vintage Newt, 90s Newt, you've got some misgivings, because you've seen kind of the weird evolution, and you've seen the drama, and you've seen the baggage, you've seen this all play out. Whereas for folks who there are some folks, I think, who are not looking at that. They're looking at Newt in his current incarnation that has literally existed since his campaign's implosion. And they're just kind of giving him, I mean, it's remarkable how I think a lot of voters have been giving Newt a really big pass.
And I mean,
all
it sounds
of this
like
baggage, you know, Fannie and Freddie, he did these ads with, and Ron Paul has rolled out an ad that a lot of folks think is going to be very damaging. We'll see. It kind of hits Newt on the same things that folks have been trying to hit Romney on, which is the flip-floppery.
You know, the tagline is serial hypocrisy.
Yeah. And so I guess the question is, to what extent will bloggers, who I think are more vocal in their misgivings about Newt, will that really matter? Or does the hit need to come not from conservative bloggers who have misgivings about Fannie and Freddie, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, but from other candidates themselves coming out and running ads? Or, you know, is this going to take Mitt Romney himself having to come out and just slam Gingrich in an interview? You know, Politico and Playbook this morning was reporting that Romney's campaign is looking to get their surrogates out there beginning to really bash Newt, even beginning to touch the personal stuff. I mean, I think that it's, in a way, there's so much baggage out there that at this point I wonder to what extent it's all just noise, that people just, they don't even care anymore, because it's just one more, like, bringing up all the bad stuff Newt has done, is that already baked into his support? And it seems as though, even though lots of conservative bloggers are expressing these misgivings about Newt, he continues to rise in the polls, and we'll see if it takes something beyond conservative bloggers and sort of to really begin to move numbers back and to watch Gingrich begin to slide again.
So what it sounds like you're saying, if I can sum up, is you have a dynamic where conservative bloggers who have longer memories follow all the twists and turns, you know, matchup statements, compare old clips, and therefore get weighed down by some of the inconsistencies over the months and years. They're not getting on board, but there's a disconnect between that class of conservative and rank and file conservatives at home watching the debates, who just like the style and the demeanor and the presentation of what he's doing, that sort of feels more authentically conservative, even when he is straying from orthodoxy on things like immigration. And therefore, the blogosphere is not, you know, the tail wagging the dog right now. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, I think it's a matter of, yes, I think that's fair, because it's a matter of how much attention you are paying to the details of the Newt saga. So if you are a reasonably well-informed voter in Iowa, you're certainly reading the papers, you may even be reading a few of these blogs, maybe you're listening to a radio show, you're hearing bits and pieces about this, but really what's forming your opinion of Newt Gingrich is, how is the press covering him right now? And even though, like, the press, you know, they talked Fannie and Freddie, and then that story seems to have kind of evaporated. Him lobbying for or doing advocacy of some kind on behalf of pharma. These are all stories that they've dropped off the radar, but I guess I can't figure out why. And while conservative bloggers are putting all these pieces together, if you're the average voter who is a busy person, the Republican GOP primary is not a big part of your life. It's something you're going to do in January, but it's not something that you spend day in and day out writing about. You probably have a very different picture of Newt, and it may be a more malleable brand. Or, quite simply, you are just looking for someone who can beat Obama and fix the economy. And so while bloggers have, they want to see purity on issue X, Y, or Z, if the average voter, taken as a whole, taken as a group, is mostly just looking for someone who can beat Obama and fix the economy, if Newt is performing well in these debates and is reasonably competent, that is the sort of input that is feeding that belief. So I think that's why you're seeing a disconnect between bloggers and their serious misgivings about Newt and the polls that are showing voters, a lot of voters saying that they don't care.
Now, who is the average Iowa voter? And I asked this in the context of a blog post that Matthew Dowd did. Matthew Dowd was a George W. Bush aide who broke ranks in 2008. I can't remember if he actually endorsed Obama or not, but he certainly was taking more pot shots at the Republican Party and trying to present himself as more of an independent in media pundit circles. And he had a post saying that organization is overrated in Iowa because it's the Iowa caucuses are not as Byzantine as the Democratic Iowa caucuses. In the Democratic Iowa caucuses, you have opportunities for horse trading and vote switching. If Kucinich and Edwards had a deal in 2008, that if Kucinich didn't have enough delegates, not enough people standing in one corner of the gymnasium, they'd send his people over to Edwards. That kind of thing you can't do, in the Republican side. But I still question what Dowd is saying because it's still a caucus and not a primary in that it's not an all-day affair like a normal election is. It's run by the party and not the state. That's the key difference between caucus and a primary. And so there are party meetings. You have to be there at the appointed time. And you have to sit through a certain amount of party bureaucratic rigmarole before you vote. Although I believe they try to get the presidential vote out of the way as soon as possible and backlit some of the other party business. Nevertheless, it's still at an appointed time on a cold, dark Iowa winter night. That's not going to be something that every Iowa Republican voter is going to go to. And so don't you still need some kind of organization to win that race? And don't you still need to have some sense of what the smaller – so it's not just the casual TV watcher you have to reach for. You still have to make sure you have a good backing with your hardcore – party foot soldier and conservative activist to win Iowa?
I guess it depends on what you think the purpose of organization is. So I think what's fascinating about this race is that what is changing people's minds, it's not even really ads on the TV. It's certainly not supporters making lots and lots and lots of phone calls or dropping literature off at people's houses. It doesn't seem. It seems as though these debates have really driven almost everything. So I guess the question is, Is organization going to turn someone who is a squishy Newt supporter who, likes Newt and thinks he would be good but has kind of misgivings about him? If you had an organization, could that bring that person out to vote versus the absence of an organization leaves that person at home? I don't know. I don't know if, calling that person's house a million times makes them go vote for Newt, whereas the absence of a bunch of phone calls from a Newt headquarters means that they don't vote. I mean, I'm wondering if...
I think we're a question of not your squishy voter, but your hardcore voter.
Why is your hardcore voter going to need 10,000 robocalls to remind them to get out to vote?
Some people need reminders. People forget. Make sure that you get your maximum number of loyal supporters at a caucus event, because if it's a close race, you might come up short.
Yeah, I mean, and I think there is some room for it, but I think that the bigger thing in this race is going to be persuasion, not organization. Even if you look back at 2008, where the primary began much earlier, I saw today Reed Wilson from Hotline, he tweeted that there had been about 26,000 ads run in Iowa at this point in 2007, whereas right now there's been under 9,000. And part of that could be because there's only one party running instead of two this go-round, but I think it's really remarkable. This primary has been a lot shorter. And even in 2008,
you have a lot less organization. I mean, that's my caveat
as far as
Gingrich is concerned.
There is. The Newt folks just got phones, apparently. I saw this on Twitter yesterday, that they were just getting phones to their office in Iowa.
Right.
So
my caveat with Newt is he may not have a good organization in Iowa, but it's not clear that anybody else has a good organization in Iowa, so it all might be for
that's true.
All
well,
be
I mean,
a wash.
I think Bachman, she talks about her organization a lot. That's the big thing that she is holding as the sort of secret weapon.
Does anyone seriously believe she has some sort of top-flight organization in Iowa?
No, I don't think so. But I mean, she won Ames. So that's proof of something. And she was able to beat Tim Pawlenty, who at that point, you know, was supposedly building this big operation in Iowa. So, I don't know that the complete absence of an organization will tank Newt, because I think a lot of these folks who want to go vote for him, they don't like him because they saw some ad he ran. They don't like him because they got a bunch of phone calls or a bunch of mail pieces saying they should like him. They like him because they watched the debates or they've heard from their friends that, hey, Newt is this new guy this time. I'm really excited to see the exit polls from these caucuses. In 2007, apparently 40% of people said that they made up their minds within the week of the caucus, and that 17% made up their minds the day of. So with this caucus, this whole primary season being even more compressed, and with really nobody having a big, big, big operation in Iowa, I wonder to what extent these decisions are really going to be made very last minute, which is why I think even though Newt is surging in the polls now, I wonder if some of these narratives that conservative bloggers are talking about eventually will begin to permeate the electorate in Iowa. And if people who right now think, I don't really care about the Fannie and Freddie stuff because I just think that he's going to be the smartest guy in the room, if eventually there's enough just erosion of that because of the ceaseless pounding of negatives that will occur either because the media will report on it or because the Romney campaign and others will begin to view Newt as a mortal threat and will do everything they can to take him out.
Right. Forgive me if I'm repeating myself from last week, but I know at the first week of December in 2003 in the Pew poll, Howard Dean was at 29% in front, and Gebhardt was also in the 20s in second place, and Kerry was in third place at 18, and this was really before, you know, any campaign put the hurt on Dean, and that happened later in December, and it became very volatile towards the end of the month, and that was also a January 3rd caucus date, if I recall. So, if you know, 4 weeks is a pretty long amount of time in a race where this Gingrich boom is still pretty new and arguably not firm. So, who knows what might transpire in the weeks to come? Outside of a 2012 business, you do have some action in Capitol Hill in terms of the portions of the 2010 tax cut deal that expire at the end of the month, and those specifically are the payroll tax cut and the long-term unemployment benefits extension. You're seeing some conservative lamenting that Democrats are outmaneuvering Republicans on this payroll tax cut deal, because the argument of some Republicans is that payroll tax cut for middle class workers bad, but and so their taxes go up next month, so what? But still, tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans, those are always good and never need to be offset. And that seems to be a position that's hard to sustain over the course of several weeks. Is there any kind of consensus view on the conservative side of things, how this debate is playing?
So there's sort of segueing from the Gingrich conversation. It's a post by Katrina Trinko at National Review where she's talking about Gingrich, who has come out supporting an extension of the payroll tax cut. And his argument is, he says, psychologically, middle-class America is out here going, okay, you don't want to repeal the Bush tax cuts. You want to keep all those tax cuts. You say you don't want them to go back up. But now we're going to let taxes go back up on every working American? I don't think psychologically you can make that case. So there are lots of folks that are of, you know, sort of looking at this issue like this is real cognitive dissonance here, that there's a tax cut on the table and that it's the Republicans who are the ones having second thoughts about it. On the other hand, there are some bloggers who have the reasons why conservatives are having their sort of second thoughts about it. You have Americans for Tax Reform, the Norquist group, that they are in favor of a payroll tax extension, but they are they're in favor of the Senate GOP's version, which is it freezes the salaries of the 2.8 billion federal workers for 3 years. It begins a process of federal hiring attrition. It means tests government welfare benefits. So if you're making more than $1 million, you can't get food stamps or unemployment compensation or government health insurance, which I'm wondering how people are getting unemployment compensation despite making more than $1 million. But apparently an issue, and so.
Well, I think with unemployment, I mean food stamps. I don't believe any millionaire is getting food stamps. But I think with unemployment, you know,
if you had a $1 million job and then you lost it.
Well, you lost it. I mean, that's the point. You lost it. And
but you made $1 million before you lost it.
I mean, you can make an argument against it, but I'm just saying I think...
Well, I mean, this is the Senate
theory has been that...
I'm wondering, like, how much does this actually save? But anyhow, go ahead. Sorry.
Right. Well, I mean, it might not save that much money, but I think the general logic of the program has been you're trying to allow people to not have to suffer economic disruption when they lose a job. And, you know, your employer is putting in money relative to your salary level. So if you are a high earner, if you lose your job and you lose that income, you get some portion of that for a limited period of time, so you don't have to completely uproot your entire life before your next job. That's generally the attitude behind it. Doesn't mean you can't argue against it for certain income levels, but there's some logic to why someone who was a high earner would qualify. Whereas with food stamps, I mean, there's a hard cap on who qualifies. Though the notion that there's some sort of loophole that millionaires are getting food stamps, I think, is kind of silly and
it also says for government health insurance. So I assume that includes Medicaid and Medicare. So is this sort of a way to means test Medicare? In which case, you and I have had this debate many a time about. Right. Republicans always want to means test entitlement programs, and Democrats never do. In a sort of weird reversal.
Some Democrats never do.
To it. Should not be painting with such a broad brush, but because it makes programs more politically vulnerable if they are means tested.
That is the argument against the mean testing of those types of programs. The adage is poor people's programs are poor programs. If you expand it, everyone has a stake in it, and then it tends to be more sustaining and work better. That's the general argument. Mm-hmm. But there are some Democrats who have pushed back on that, saying if times are tight and we have to save money, and that's a safer way to get some money. So I would not be surprised. I think the Democratic counterproposals on the payroll tax cut have allowed for some means testing of an unemployment insurance, and the food stamps are kind of like, well, whatever, this isn't even a real issue, so fine. So you know, that might be a point of compromise there, but it still seems like that wouldn't be enough to get a good chunk of the rank and file House members on board, from what I'm reading in, you know, The Hill and Politico and other places.
Yeah, well, and so there's the arguments against this. Is not that Republicans suddenly don't like tax cuts, but rather that the trade-offs involved are not favorable. So William McBride, blogging at U.S. News Debate Club, he's an economist with the Tax Foundation, and his claim is that he says this is basically the 2012 version of cash for clunkers, that we keep putting in place these kind of Band-Aid tax cuts, but that if a tax cut is temporary, that it doesn't really do what the point of a tax cut is. Like, Republicans and Democrats have long tried to do stimulus by, if you put more money temporarily back in people's pockets, this will jumpstart the economy. Bush did it by mailing people checks. Obama is trying it with temporary tax cuts, and that in neither case is it really working, because folks know that eventually taxes are going to go back up, or they know that it's this chunk of money and then it's gone, rather than a sort of permanent change in the rates that would alter incentives and things like that. So in the same way that cash for clunkers, you know, may have incentivized people to buy more cars sooner, but didn't necessarily incentivize people to buy more cars as a whole looking over the long term. It just made them move their spending decisions up. McBride says that that's basically what this will do, that it will cut taxes for 1 year while levying a permanent surtax on millionaires. So it's kind of trading a short, temporary holiday for some people in exchange for a permanent tax increase on another group of people. And that if you're going to permanently raise taxes on one group of people, both sides of this deal should be permanent. Now, I don't know that conservatives would wind up supporting it anyways with a permanent increase in the progressivity of the tax code.
I find interesting that there's still this conservative line of argument against cash for clunkers when by most accounts have worked, and the auto industry is doing much. That's the only reason why the auto industry is doing better, but
not the only reason why the auto industry is doing
there's
better.
There's also the broader auto industry restructuring that the president handled, but auto sales are doing much better now than before cash for clunkers, and there was a big spike in activity in that month. It came down after that.
Yeah, exactly.
But then it kept gradually increasing after that point. So you could argue different ways, but I think it's certainly hard from an optics standpoint to say, aha, they tried to save the audit industry and it didn't work from the stupid program.
I don't think so at all. I think conservatives would be very comfortable trying to make the argument that things, I mean, you had even very popular things, like it was said, oh, we're going to give this new homeowner tax credit, buy a new home right now. And that didn't fix the housing market at all. The housing market is still perhaps even in worse shape than it was. You know, I mean, yes, Republicans like giving tax cuts, but the idea of giving sort of permanent tax incentives to encourage behavior, unfortunately, is often encouraging temporary changes in behavior that don't really improve the things like the housing market or improve the economy overall, because it is just temporary. So that's
But the issue with the cars is that two things happened. There was a temporary measure, and there was a permanent measure in the industry restructuring. And it's like the president is only offering temporary solutions. He has this thing called the American Jobs Act, which is a much more longer term, job creation strategy. And it's not like the Republicans are saying, oh, thank goodness for your permanent job solution. I will happily support that now. There are two prongs what the president's talking about. And it seems if you're going to criticize it in some kind of holistic way, not complain about temporary here and then complain about the permanent thing over there. Make up your mind.
Well, and conservatives would have any problem talking about how they oppose the government's involvement in GM and the bailouts of the auto companies. That's certainly not an argument that they've ever shied away from. Mm-hmm. I mentioned that there's back and forth on this. So you had this Will McBride post about why he opposed it. You have Véronique de Rougie, who also writes at U.S. News Debate Club. She's talking about how a more permanent solution is needed. But she actually thinks that she said this is a new practice, this sort of budget gimmick of temporarily, like, kind of pulling money out of the Social Security Trust Fund, that's a gimmick that's been done before. But the good news is that by doing something like this, by cutting the payroll tax and really beginning to starve Social Security, it exposes the fiction that Social Security benefits are fully backed by payroll tax contributions and hence can't be reformed. Social Security is already running a cash flow deficit, meaning there's not enough money to pay retirees' benefits. With a payroll tax cut extension adding to the program's financial difficulties, it may be the impetus for Congress to pursue fundamental entitlement reform and address the underlying drivers of our debt problem. So she actually thinks this would sort of be she's making a starve the beast argument that by putting less money into Social Security, we wind up making more stark the problems and the solvency in the program on a shorter term, and perhaps create political cover for politicians to do something about it.
Well, and there's a strain of the left that never liked the payroll tax idea for this very reason, that they were concerned that it was going to weaken public support for Social Security and make it easier for the austerity posse to push the cuts that they want. And you still see some congressional Democrats withholding support on that logic. My own group, Campaign for America's Future, we are supporting the tax cut extension as just sort of like the bare minimum that should be done to keep the middle class afloat, in the current economic situation. But we also have commentary on our site saying, this still makes us uncomfortable, what this might do to Social Security. I would personally, and Richard Eskow, I'd say one of our bloggers there, had a big post on that very point just a couple days ago. But my own personal take is, I understand the theory behind the argument from the left that this is going to weaken support for Social Security, but we've done it for a year, and I don't believe that it has. It hasn't been this cavalcade of experts saying that the finances of the program are now weaker than they were before this. There are people who always said they're weak, and there are people who always say that they're strong, and no one's moved their position because of the tax cut, the temporary tax cut, because the revenues are being replenished from other sources, and the program's based in the same place that it was a year ago. So it's interesting you're seeing some conservative folks trying to push this argument. That might push the buttons on some folks on the left who are concerned about that argument taking hold, but I don't get the sense that it is taking hold.
Yeah, I've seen that make it, but I haven't seen the starve the beast argument as a centerpiece. I think most of the misgiving is – Are we giving, by supporting this payroll tax cut, are we giving the Democrats a win while in exchange we would have to take something like a permanent increase in taxes on the wealthy that we think is bad for the economy, that we think is going to raise taxes on 18% of small businesses, that we think is going to raise tax, you know, I mean, so it's, Republicans are very cognizant that they are stuck in a really between a rock and a hard place, and I think that the argument about this, the starving of the program and its implications for entitlement reform is really secondary to the more immediate concern about, like, is there any way for us to oppose this on policy grounds that isn't us just supporting tax cuts for the rich.
Right.
It's a very, it's a weird day in Washington. There's a tax cut on the table and Republicans are thinking twice.
Right. I mean, so it sounds like the blogosphere is just as split as the congressional Republican caucus. So the other thing, just to talk quickly about it, the president gave a speech this week at the same site where Theodore Roosevelt gave a speech called the New Nationalism Speech, which was a precursor to his third party run in 1912 after he'd already served as president, where it's a very broad brush vision of what a progressive America would look like when special interests are reined in and there's no corporate financing of campaigns and I think things of that nature. And the president made some of his most pointed comments on the subject of inequality that I think he's made in his presidency. And you're seeing some folks on the left very excited about the tone that he's taking. Michael Tomasky says it's the best speech that he's given in his presidency, and he's properly framing the issue. He's setting up what 2012 is going to be, sort of whose side are you on as far as the middle class is concerned. But you also have some folks like my Campaign for America's Future colleague Richard Eskow, who's saying this rhetoric is nice and all, but show me the policies. You still have some folks on the left that feel like the policies that Obama has done have not been populist enough. So I don't know if it's necessarily salving all of the wounds that exist on the left in terms of his overarching record at this point. But at minimum, it does seem to be the beginnings of how he would frame the 2012 race. And if you ask me, I don't think that the speech is that big a departure from a lot of other speeches that he's given. It's just maybe this one's gotten a little bit more attention because some of the rhetoric was a little bit more pointed. But I think he's been trying to touch on these themes for several months now, refining it, sharpening it to get ready for the presidential campaign, which, you know, I mean, these caucuses are only a few weeks away. I think he's well aware that, you know, he's essentially in the presidential campaign season. But I don't know if there's been that much, you know, the left is sort of reads the tea leaves more on Obama's speeches sometimes more than the right does.
I think that the tweet that I remember coming out during the speech was that they were just waiting for Obama to quote, "What's the matter with Kansas?" The book about how people in states like Kansas supposedly vote against their own economic interests because of the social issues in the Republican Party, which sounds like, you know, a lot of what the speech is like, you know, hey, people in Kansas or whatever state you're in, I'm the president that's looking out for your economic interests. Republicans are just looking out for, you know, big bad corporations or the wealthy. So I think it's sort of like a doubling down. I mean, it's clear what Obama's strategy is going to be. It's clear that this strategy was born out of the idea that Romney will be a nominee. I think, you know, these are the kinds of arguments you make when you're running against somebody who is the CEO of Bain Capital. I think it just, for me, and for many, it seems like it was sort of a doubling down on your class warfare, your Occupy Wall Street, whatever it is that you call this focus on, the rich guys have it better than you and that's not fair sort of mantra, that this populist thing. I mean, it sounds like he's going to take this populist tack, and we'll see how it goes.
Well, read the Tomasky piece in the Daily Beast about this, because his assessment of the speech is essentially that he avoids those pitfalls, that he doesn't take the "What's the matter with Kansas?" line, where he sort of, you know, blames the voters for not voting their own interests, and he doesn't simply just regurgitate Occupy Wall Street rhetoric. He's not making it 99% versus 1%. He talks about these are American values, not 99% values or 1% values. They're American values. And And so Tomaskis, he basically has, you know, taken some of that energy from the populist left, but cleaned it up and refined in a way that's much more broadly appealing to a, what he, I think, called a majoritarian audience. So, again, that's just one man's view, Tomaskis' view. But interesting, if conservatives maybe want to take a closer look at the speech and say, wait a second, is Obama touching on something here? Has he found a way to talk about this in a way that might be a little bit tougher to counter than just simply accusing him of class warfare?
Yeah, I don't know that there's been as nuanced a take on it as what you just provided. I think the idea is that this is sort of being lumped into the broader narrative that Obama, on the right, that Obama scores political wins by engaging in class warfare. This was just another speech of long, many, 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 many long speeches that Obama has given. And I don't think that this was seen as something that stood out as markedly different or a turning point or a window into some sort of new strategy for the future. But I don't necessarily think that you're wrong. I think that the right would be wise to take a look at this speech and realize that this is not just Obama trying to rile up his base, but this is something that clearly he and his administration think is going to be a winner, is going to be a winner with independent voters, is going to be a winner with middle-class voters, white middle-class voters in particular, where his approval ratings have really, really tanked. I think this is the beginnings of the year to come. And so I would encourage conservatives to take it seriously.
Well, perhaps we should leave it on that note.
All right.
Always good to talk to you, Kristen.
As same to you, Bill.
Where can folks find your material when you're not talking with me?
You can find it at KristenSoltis.com, or you can find it at the Independent Women's Forum Inkwell blog.
And you can find my stuff at ourfuture.org, the Campaign for America's Future site, as well as my podcast, Liberal Oasis Radio Show, at liberaloasis.com. And until